Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, and speak with Stanley Greenberg, the former pollster for Bill Clinton and co-author with James Carville of the new book, It's the Middle Class Stupid. We will discuss what President Obama needs to do tonight and the memo that Stan Greenberg and James Carville wrote to President Obama, the big things that Obama can get done at his convention. Then we'll examine ways that President Obama might reawaken the youth vote that put him over the top in 2008. Mike Lux, the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, joins us. He was a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House, and we will discuss his article in the Huffington Post about the choices facing Americans in this election. What kind of people will we be? Then finally, we will speak with veteran journalist Peter Stone, who has been tracking money and politics for decades. We will discuss the many issues in the Democratic platform that will likely not be discussed on stage at the convention: gun control, raising the minimum wage, slowing and reversing climate change, and most of all, campaign finance reform. And joining us now from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, is Stanley Greenberg, who was a pollster for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, South African President Nelson Mandela, and many others. He is the co-founder with James Carville of Democracy Corps and the chairman and CEO of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. He and James Carville are the co-authors of the new book, It's the Middle Class Stupid, and they've just written a memo to Barack Obama, the big things that Obama can get done at his convention. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stan Greenberg.
I'm delighted to be here from this very exciting place.
And so far, the Democrats are looking great. I mean, how unusual for them to be organized. The trains are running on time. The speeches are fantastic. It's really quite impressive.
And who would have thought that the management consultant candidate for president would have such a bumbling convention, failing to manage prime time? It's pretty stunning. But the focus on this, I mean, you can feel it in the hall. You can, you talk to the press. You talk to observers and pundits. There is such energy, and reinforced by the speeches, which have been very strong, and making the case for the president and his direction, and we'll see what happens tonight and where the president takes it.
Well, clearly there's a lot at stake and a lot riding on this. There's an expectation that this is going to be a pivotal moment. I don't know whether the president can reinvent himself back to 2008, but that's in a way what's expected. I mean, if everybody that voted in 2008 voted in this election, we wouldn't be having this conversation, would we, Stan?
No, we wouldn't. And obviously, if the president came out of this with the 53% of the country that voted for him saying they're going to do that again and give him a shot, that would be a great result. But it's not 2008, and the voters know it's not 2008. It's actually not the expectation for real people. As they they look at this, they've been through a pretty brutal economy. They have, I think, pretty smart and realistic views of what the nature of the problems are. I mean, if you ask in a poll right now, many, many more people say that George Bush is responsible for this economy and for the debt than the president. So that's in people's head. But they what they want to know is, where are you going to take the country? What's your vision? Where are you going to go? They are, I think, ready. They have great respect for the president, and I think the convention has had reinforced, he's been focused on them as he's made these big decisions. But they want to know, how's this going to be better? How's this going to be a stronger country? How's the middle class going to prosper?
Well, your partner at Democracy Corps, James Carville, of course, is famous for the line, it's the economy, stupid, and clearly you have played on that with your new book that you've written together, Stan Greenberg, It's the Middle Class, Stupid. And when you recognize it's the economy, stupid, it sort of is an anti-intellectual concept, isn't it, that people simply vote robotically because things aren't going well for them economically and they don't look at the big picture. Is that what we're up against here?
No, and I don't think people vote robotically, but the message is the economy, stupid, was a kind of a message to the campaign, but, you know, message to the candidate. You know, the elites have their own, you know, very broad agenda, and frankly, a lot of Democrats. I remember in 1992, there were a whole range of social issues that Democrats assumed they'd run on, from environment to, you know, to abortion. And what we were saying, what James was saying, because he coined the word, but it was part of the strategic messaging of the campaign, is it's the economy. It's the number one issue. It's the driving issue. And if you make your politics around the economy, you know, you'll bring back the working class Reagan voters who, you know, Democrats had lost, and you'll create a mandate, you know, which the president, you know, President Clinton, who was so good, President Clinton, went to a joint session of Congress, you know, after that election, said, I'm going to speak only about the economy, you know, and then was able to pass his economic plan, which probably had, you know, seriously contributed to the prosperity of the 90s. And what we're saying here, it's the middle class, stupid. You know, that's, you know, if you want to, that's the main problem facing the country. You know, will the middle class have a future? You know, our research says that if you build your politics around that, that's the best way to beat Romney. But it's also, if you have an election about the middle class, then your mandate is, you know, what are you going to do to make the middle class more prosperous when we get over? How are we going to make sure we have a prosperity that rises, but where everybody rises?
But you've been looking at the polls that say that the Republican-leaning independents pay more attention in this period that's between now and the election, this critical period. And the point about it's the economy, stupid, is the shoe's on the other foot now, surely. That's what Romney's trying to sell, isn't it? And how's he doing?
I think you're right. I think that is his strategy. What we were trying to say was that what happens when you lead into a Republican convention, that the Republican-leaning independents pay much more attention and are much more central in the polls that get taken. But the same is true, by the way, for the Democratic convention. So as the polls are conducted, during and right after the Democratic convention, there'll be a lot of independents who lean Democratic, who are pretty partisan Democratic in their thinking, who will answer the surveys, and so you'll get a contrary bounce, you know, for the Democrats. So they'll balance each other out. But you're right about Romney. Romney is, you know, in some ways saying it's the economy, stupid, but it's his definition of the economy, which is how you doing? How have you done over the last 4 years? Are you doing personally better? You know, that's the question he's asking. We're saying it's the future of the middle class, stupid. That's the question, and I think that's where the president is very likely to go, because, you know, frankly, normal voters, they don't want to have an election about the last 4 years. They know that it's complicated. They know, you know, it was both a financial crash that was disastrous, but they also know there was a long-term economic decline of the middle class that was even more important. They want to know what you're going to do. And if the president is big, if he goes long, you know, if he offers a big vision, you know, I think, you know, the Romney argument can look, I think, very small.
So the Romney appeal, in terms of him trying to co-opt it's the economy, stupid, is, I suppose, given that he's probably the richest candidate to run for president of the United States, he's had his problems. He's actually been quite hard-nosed about not revealing his tax returns, and the Democrats have been able to point out that, along with having Swiss bank accounts and Cayman Island accounts, etc. But there is this part of a uniquely American aspirational politics that you too can become a millionaire. And clearly that is the subtext, I think, of all of what Romney's saying. You know, don't criticize if you're being stupid, being successful. You too can be successful too, and I'll make you successful by the kind of trickle-down magic that I'll bring to the presidency. How is Obama going to go aspirational too?
I think you're right that that's what he's betting on. That, and at his convention, it's kind of the first time that he's really embraced, you know, his time as a, you know, as a business person and his wealth, and, you know, stated clearly that if people like me are doing well, it's, you know, it's good for the country. Respect the people who take risks in this economy. That's how you have a successful economy. And so that, for sure, he, you know, has tried to honor the people that have, you know, wealth. The problem is the country's in a different place. This is not a moment when you ask about the American dream that people are talking, you know, about Horatio Alger. They are in the polls that we do and others do. The two things that stand out right now is, in terms of the American dream, is do I have a family? Can I keep my family together? You know, and do I have any spare money? Do I have anything left? You know, for a little bit more. You know, maybe get a steak, maybe go on a vacation. But in this desperate financial situation, being middle class and the American dream is, and then that's followed by being able to educate your kids. These are big things, you know, that, you know, if you want, you know, look at Charles Murray's, you know, book as a conservative, intellectual and researcher, and who's argued that the family is crashing. You know, the working class family is crashing in America. The family's in trouble and people are trying to hold it together. People are moving. We do focus groups. We ask about what's happening with the economy. People talk about moving in back in with a spouse because they don't have the money, or they move in back in with their parents, or their kids have moved in. I mean, it's a wreck out there. I mean, it's a mess. I mean, as people try to survive, you know, this. And so when we get to the American dream, you know, they're not dreaming of having, a garage with elevators in which they can take their, car up to another level. They're just, they're just hoping for a little bit of space, a little bit of room. And if you look at, what President Clinton said, and you look at the first night of the convention with Michelle Obama in the keynote address, it was all very focused, on the family, people who worked hard, tried to, pass on a middle-class life to their kids. That was the identity that they were trying to pass through for Barack Obama, and the Democratic Party. And I think they're in a much stronger position. The president is, and we'll see what he does tonight, in a much stronger position to identify with that.
Well, the Republican convention, I think almost every minority that they had in that hall, because it was so incredibly white, were the people on stage.
90% of the delegates were white.
Right. And most of the minorities were on stage speaking. Now, it's quite different, obviously, with the Democratic convention. But the Obama White House is talking about, reviewed the Republican convention in terms of an old black and white Ozzie and Harriet TV show. And now there's no question that Ronald Reagan appealed to that kind of Ozzie and Harriet atavism of going back to the Eisenhower days when the American dream was in its full flush. Of course, in those days, minorities and blacks and Latinos weren't counted, and they certainly are counted today. So the real question is, I think, is there enough enthusiasm with the new and newly enfranchised minorities in this country compared to the anger that seems to be motivating the older white electorate that feels that the American dream is being taken away from them by a bunch of freeloaders? And we know that that's what Ryan and Romney have been stoking, that kind of those fires.
Yeah, look, they've not been subtle. They've been trying to introduce welfare into this. The advertising they've done on health care reform is essentially saying they're giving this to poor people for benefits they did not pay for, and you get nothing. I mean, they have a very focused me focus, very much focused on older voters, older white voters, and probably more working class voters. I'm not sure it's going to work. I'm just saying that's what they're trying. That's their shot, and it's a dangerous shot because maybe in this period of very tough economic times, they can get through. I don't think so. I think President Obama will win this, but you pay a price for that long term in terms of the young people and the diverse the diverse population. And also the more tolerant population that we have in the suburbs, even the more affluent suburbs, who are not very comfortable, don't view this as a very relevant kind of politics. And so there's a real price for that. I mean, they are running, obviously they're trying to suppress the vote of minority voters and Latino voters and African-American voters. But you pay a generational price for disenfranchising voters. You can't say, it's not just a policy difference. When you try to, keep people from having the right to vote, you pay a generational, price that we'll see what happens. I think the country has changed to the point that this is not likely to be effective. You know, I talk about it. We talk about it in the book, It's the Middle Class Stupid. You know, when I did this research, you know, about Reagan Democrats, it was all about race. But it's much more now about the structure of the economy. You know, older white working class voters, you know, they may not, you know, they may, you know, be a little uncomfortable with parts of the health care bill. But they are, you know, they think the structure of this economy with CEOs and outsourcing, you know, they think that's the main source, you know, of the economic problems they face, you know, not, you know, that minorities are getting unfair advantage.
Well, the evidence is overwhelming that it is. I mean, anybody that can look at the demographic changes you've got in this country, the phenomenon of what just one family, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, own the equivalent wealth of 40% of the bottom of Americans. So that's an extraordinary reality that we're dealing with here. But just in terms of the enthusiasm gap, though, you can see that the Republicans are fired up and they're going to pull out all the stops and money will be unlimited. And we have a bit of a preview of that from what happened in the election in Wisconsin, yep, where every house got was visited with both mailers, people, and the airwaves were carpet bombed. So that's, I think, to be expected. I'm just curious to know about the enthusiasm gap in terms of the minority voters on the Democratic side. There doesn't seem to be the young white college kids. I don't think they're showing up as they did last time. So what's your polling tell you about who needs to show up and who will show up on the Democratic side?
Yeah, I mean, you raise the right issue, and there's no doubt this is not 2008. I mean, the voters who, you know, gave big majorities to Barack Obama are some of the voters, you know, hit hardest by the economy. You know, African Americans, Latinos, you know, young people, unmarried women, you know, they were hit, you know, very hard, you know, by this economy. And, you know, they didn't turn out very well in 2010 off year elections. Now, some of these voters, you know, are coming back. African Americans, you know, voted not at a bad rate in 2010, and I think they're going to, you know, vote in large numbers, I think, to protect the president. But Latino voters, there's evidence that they are moving. Very much in reaction to what Romney has done in the Republican primary and the anti-immigrant sentiment that's been fueled on their side. And having the Republicans having the DREAM Act is very popular. We've polled in California and nationally. In California, for the for USC and LA Times, that the DREAM Act, you know, a plurality, I think, against amongst Anglos, but amongst Latinos, it's very, very high. And I think Romney campaigning against it and, you know, and opposing what President Obama did, I think has, you know, shifted the balance there. The vote has shifted, and I think the intensity has shifted. So I think we're seeing, I think, increased minority. But young people are very tough, you know, right now. And obviously the Republicans have focused, and Ryan has focused, you know, on the young people.
With the faded, posters on the wall, right? The faded Obama posters.
Yeah, no.
But the point is,
they're looking at this, and right, they're just not. You know, young people are not voting Democratic at the same level they were right in 2008, and above all, they're not voting at the same levels.
Right.
You know, the turnout in the off-year elections were very low for young people, and I think that's probably likely to be true. Now, this convention, You know, it's pretty engaging, and but we'll have to see what the data, you know, is.
Right.
The Republican convention mainly drew in partisans, and they didn't get much of a bounce. You know, the question is whether this convention will be watched by that broad base of people who helped elect Obama. This is not like the core group of Democrats I'm talking about. You know, I'm talking about the broad, you know, unmarried women, single women, young people, actually fairly affluent suburban voters, minority voters. You know, there's a very broad swath of people who gave Obama, you know, his majority. Will they be engaged by this convention, and will the president's speech get to them?
Well, just in the last minute then, just to summarize, because we've run out of time, and I just want to get your points across here in your memo. to President Obama. Number one, go big and aspirational. Number two, I'll tax the rich. He'll cut their taxes. And number three, define Romney. I don't think anybody has done it better than your colleague, James Carville, who on the Colbert Show said that if you want George Bush's domestic policy, Dick Cheney's foreign policy, and Rick Santorum's social policy, then vote for Romney. Then you've got number four, embrace Obamacare. You know, the Democrats or the White House have certainly seemed to have dropped the ball on embracing it from day one. And then number five, speak for the vulnerable. Of course, Michelle Obama did that a couple of nights ago. And just in closing, any of those points that you want to jump on?
No, I think they're on. I think the tax issue is very important piece here that's not yet played out. It's very clear the president wants, to raise taxes on the wealthy, to pay for what we have to do as a country. The country's with him on that. Romney really was kind of hiding from his tax proposals, cutting taxes for the rich at his convention. I am sure that distinction will be drawn very clearly by the president. And if you look at the poll data right now, amazingly, and this is multiple polls, and the news networks as well. Right now, the Democrats and Republicans are trusted evenly on who you would trust to handle taxes. So if Republicans don't have their signature economic policy as something on which you trust them, there's something going on, and I think the president should really push that ball.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stanley Greenberg.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Stanley Greenberg, who's been talking to us from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. He was a pollster for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, South African President Nelson Mandela, and many others. He is the co-founder with James Carville of Democracy Corps and the chairman and CEO of Greenberg Quinlan Ross Research. He and James Carville are the co-authors of the new book, It's the Middle Class Stupid, and they've just written a memo to Barack Obama, The Big Things That Obama Can Get Done at His Convention. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how Obama can reawaken the youth vote. What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lux, a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995, and he's the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. He has an article at the Huffington Post, What Kind of People Will We Be? Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And clearly the president's keynote speech tonight is a lot's riding on it, and there's a lot of expectation. I don't imagine you can revive the hope and change energy from 2008, but that's what many people require of him. What are you hoping that President Obama achieves tonight?
Well, I think that he can revive the spirit of 2008. You know, when you're president, it's a long, hard slog, and it's not like running for president. So the circumstances have changed. We've also just been through a terrible economic time that was caused by Wall Street greed and manipulation of the markets, and people are not out of their funk because the economy hasn't gotten better as fast as any of us would have wanted. So, I don't think that optimism or pure joy and hope is exactly called for or realistic, but I think what the president can do is he can make the case that he brought the country back from the brink, and that if you compare what he wants to do the next 4 years with what Romney wants to do, there is an absolutely fundamental difference, both in policies and in values. And I think he can express that well. I think he can make the case as to why people should pick him over Romney.
Well, there seems to be a kind of tradition in Democratic politics, particularly when there are weak candidates, and there's no question that both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are strong candidates, that at the end of the day, the appeal is, you know, look, what about the Supreme Court? What if you don't vote for this guy? The other guys are going to ruin the place. Now, how do you mix these messages? On the one hand, it seems like it would be a good time to remind the American people, as James Carville did on the Colbert show the other night, where he had a very simple message, which is, if you want to vote for Mitt Romney, then you're voting for George W. Bush's domestic policy, Dick Cheney's foreign policy, and Rick Santorum's social policy. That's a pretty succinct message, right? So how do you give those messages on the one hand, and on the other hand, the inspirational messages about what we stand for and what we're going to do?
Well, I think you can do both. I think you can make the contrast. Look, the negative message is an easy one to make, as James did well. But, you know, you can sum up the negative message in this. You know, in the 1990s, Bill Clinton was president. He made a lot of mistakes, but by God, look at what happened in the 1990s. 22 million jobs created, a surplus instead of a deficit, rising incomes for people. For the only time, really, in the last 30 years, you look at what George Bush gave us, and it was the opposite in abundance. When you talk about oh my God, terrible things will happen if the Republicans win, they did happen. We proved that point. There can be no more doubt about that. So I think that case is easy to make, but I think more importantly, you can make the positive case with contrast. Look, the question is, what kind of country do we want to be? What kind of values do we have as a nation? Do we have the values of Bain Capital and Paul Ryan's hero, Ayn Rand? Who basically believed, that the rich and powerful should win everything and let the devil take the hindmost, or do we have the values that Barack Obama has been talking about for the last 4 years, which are that we sink or swim together, that we are an American community, an American family, and that we need to give each other a hand. We need to help each other. We need to be a community. That kind of values, that fundamental difference in values, is what this campaign is all about. And I think we can make that case quite well.
Now, one of the things that I found most disturbing, and a lot of people did, quite a lot of coverage in the press about it, that Paul Ryan's very cynical speech where he just lied with abandon, and frankly, all of the commercials, ads that Romney have made throughout his entire campaign, starting in Iowa, where he put John McCain's word in President Obama's mouth and continues to do so, shows a tremendous, breathtaking cynicism on both Ryan and Romney's part. And in effect, what they're doing there is they cynically know they're lying, but their job is to stir up the rubes on their side to get them furious at Obama and get them out to vote. And to me, people with that kind of attitude towards their own voters, let alone manufacturing hate towards the opponent, are really beyond the pale. And I'm just wondering, Is there any way that Obama can appeal to the Republican voters who are being hoodwinked by their leadership, who are deliberately lying to them?
I don't think Obama can appeal to most Republican voters. I mean, most Republicans are pretty hardcore in their beliefs. I think what Obama can do is there's a very modest number of swing voters who are thinking about voting for Romney, but also thinking about voting for Obama and haven't made up their mind yet. There are voters who aren't sure they're going to vote, and that's the biggest single group in the election. But if they do come out and vote, they're likely to vote with Obama. And there's some weak Republican voters that you might be able to get. But I think this election has become sort of rock hard. I just don't think there's going to be much movement either way in the days and weeks to come. I think you're looking at about a 47-47 race. I don't think that's going to change much. I think that there's going to be a very small group of undecided folks all the way to the end, and everybody else is pretty set in their ways. And I think that's actually fairly unique if you look back over the history of presidential politics. You know, there's been a lot more bouncing around in the polls, but I think people have pretty much decided whether they think a bad economy is Obama's fault or not, whether they think Romney's a good guy or not. They've pretty well settled on what they believe about this race. So Obama has to pump up the people who aren't sure they're going to vote, but who, if they do, will vote for him, and he's got to appeal to those last few swing voters.
Well, apparently, if everybody that voted in 2008 voted this time, it would be a walk for Obama. And obviously, the Republicans have gone out of their way to try and suppress the vote. You know, the Brennan Center at NYU says that up to 5 million votes have been scrubbed. So that's adding to the uphill climb. But again, I find the cynicism of the Republicans breathtaking, the idea that a handful of billionaires, particularly the Koch brothers, can actually create a phony grassroots movement called the Tea Party. I mean, it's amazing that you can actually, it's not just one thing in politics for the wealthy to buy their politicians and get them to obediently enact their agenda, but it's another thing to buy a whole political movement that is the opposite of what it pretends to be.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I wouldn't say that exactly that they're buying a movement, because those people who are out there in the Tea Party, really, they are real people, and they do exist. They've been manipulated. They're the people who are putting all the money into buses to take people to things and all these conferences and all these things that are, you know, making it seem more like a movement. They believe the opposite as a lot of the Tea Party rhetoric is. But those are real folks. I mean, that's a reality that we can't ignore. Now, they're a pretty small minority, but I think what the Tea Party folks and the Koch brothers, who put all the money in, have shown is that if you can get a small minority organized, they can change the way Americans think about their political system. Now, fortunately, people having gone that direction in 2010 are coming back around to a more sane point of view, and the Tea Party is very unpopular right now. But it does show what, you know, if you combine money and some people willing to get out in the streets, it does show what you can do.
Well, then why not apply that to the Democrats? In other words, if a right-wing astroturf movement largely funded by bilious billionaires can essentially take over the Republican Party, why not a progressive, energetic reform group take over the Democratic Party? And I mean, you've written about it, Mike Lux, in The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. It certainly feels like we're overdue for a progressive revolution, particularly given that we're in a second gilded age. How do you apply that logic of what the Tea Party did to the Republicans to what a potential movement could do to the Democratic Party? Because I don't know what the disaffection is amongst those that the young who voted in 2008. But you know, there's always the perennial disaffection from the Green Party and others on the fringes of the political left. So, do you think that there's any way that progressives can take a leaf out of the Tea Party's book?
Well, I think they can. Although I think that their culture, the Tea Party's culture, is a very different culture than progressive culture. So it's going to have to be a movement on its own terms. But yes, I absolutely think that we progressives need to take to the streets more. I think we need to flex our electoral muscles more, the same way the Tea Party did. I think we need to look for alliances between grassroots progressives and progressive donors. So yes, I think all of that needs to happen and should happen. I think though we're going to have to build it ourselves rather than being copycats and following another right wing movement's way of doing things.
So do you think then, Mike Lux, that the deficit in funding, the scrubbing of the, you said it's basically 47-47, and it's going to be tied all the way to the end. It seems to me that the Republican calculus is basically to, you know, spend record amounts of money at the last minute, because we don't know how much they've got in store. But because of these 501c4 super PACs, it's impossible to know how much money they have and how much money corporate America is pouring in there. But the assumption is that based upon what happened in the recall election in Wisconsin, they were able to literally contact every home with both people, mail, and phone calls, and not to mention carpet bomb the airwaves. So how is the president going to overcome that deficit? Because I suspect at the last minute, they're really going to pull out all the stops.
Well, there's no doubt about it, and there's no question whatsoever that the right wing is going to outspend us in this race. The Koch brothers have basically promised over $200 million, and the rumor is that in exchange for putting Ryan on the ticket, they just promised Romney another $100 million on top of the $200 million. So they alone are spending, you know, just unbelievable amounts of money. And there have been a massive amount already, and they're going to be continue to be. It's just going to be incredible. But we're going to have to overcome it by grassroots. We're going to have to overcome it by the best turnout operation that we've ever had. And we're going to have to overcome it by going back to making an argument, as I said before, about our basic values. Do you want a president who has the values of Bain Capital and Ayn Rand, that selfishness is good and devil take the hindmost? Or do you want a president with the values who believes in community and in people helping each other and in us working together, sinking or swimming together? That's the question I think we have to push. And I think we can win with that message, even though we are going to be outspent.
Well, let me ask you, Mike Lux, about just taking the temperature of the American people here in terms of cynicism versus optimism. There's no question, as I mentioned earlier, that the Republican convention was full of cynicism, both in terms of the alacrity with which the presidential and the vice presidential candidate lied, but the way that they lied to their own people just to sort of cynically stir them up. And the most disturbing line of all was in Romney's speech, where he said very derisively that President Obama promised to stop the oceans rising and to heal the earth. I'll look after you and your family, something along those lines. And this is a man, you know, that goes on stage with all of his grandchildren and is apparently a relatively intelligent and educated man who simply must know that global warming is real. Yet again, he's throwing a bone to the most ignorant kind of pandering. It's just shocking. So I'm just wondering, is a counter-appeal to the better angels of America's nature? Or, you know, is this sort of old adage that nice guys finish last How cynical do you think we are as a people?
Well, you know, I don't think we're actually that cynical as a people. I think that you can appeal to the greater good. You can appeal to American community, and I think you can win with that. It helps that the policies also work. I mean, this is not just about values. That the George Bush, Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan policies are a disaster and have no realistic chance at all of helping the economy. And I think Obama can make a very strong case about that. But I also think, and I think at the end of the day, people are going to have to choose. Do you want the values of this group of cold-hearted guys who believe that doing what Mitt Romney did at Bain Capital, you know, stripping workers of everything, being a pioneer in outsourcing, taking away workers' pensions, loading up companies with debt and leaving them to die and taking management fees to make money on the deal. If you believe those values are good values versus the kind of values of helping each other that Barack Obama is espousing, then, you know, you can choose that. But I don't think that's what the American people ultimately want to do. I'm more worried that what they will say is, well, Obama's policies aren't working, so I'm going to go with the other guy. That's the biggest danger in this campaign, and that's the cynicism, the kind of cynicism that the Republicans are counting on. But they don't want to actually explain their policies or be honest about their values, because people would find both their values and their policies repugnant. You know, most people disagree with them on those fundamental things. They're cynically counting on the idea that because people are economically stressed, that they're going to pick a new person just because of that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mike Lux.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lux, who's a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the President for Public Liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995, and is the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. He has an article at the Huffington Post, What Kind of People Will We Be? We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether campaign finance reform will be in the President's speech tonight. I'm amazed at what the people say. I'm amazed by a divided nation. I'm amazed at the love we rejected. I'm amazed what we accepted as place. After all is said and hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Stone, who's formerly the head of the Money and Politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. He's been writing about money and politics for over two decades as a journalist for the Legal Times and the National Journal. He began his career at the California-based muckraking magazine Ramparts, and his latest book is Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. He's now writing a new book on Citizens United and super PACs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Stone.
Good to be with you.
And yesterday, the New York Times had a lead editorial, Words Not Spoken, going through the many issues that are in the Democratic Party platform, but not necessarily will we hear about them on stage at the convention, like gun control, dealing with climate change, dealing with the minimum wage, etc. But the one that I think they single out is a demand for campaign finance reform by a constitutional amendment, if necessary. Do you think that the president tonight is going to address this issue, which I would think, he's really got a dog in this fight, doesn't he? He's being outspent massively by the Republicans.
I think he probably does. I mean, he certainly has a dog in this fight. But I think in terms of the array of issues he's probably going to be talking about, this at best will only get a brief mention. I mean, they have been on record saying that they would like some kind of campaign finance reform. They've switched their position on this at different times. I think early on, the key issue for the administration was the high court ruling, the Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United, in early 2010, which opened the door for corporations, individuals, and unions to give unlimited amounts of money to outside groups for ads and other electoral tools directly advocating for a candidate's election. This was something the Republicans capitalized on early, much more rapidly than the Democrats in the 2010 election. This cycle, we have seen outside Republican groups vastly outraise and outspend Democratic outside groups. We're talking about these new super PACs, which have to disclose their donors, the most prominent being the one that Karl Rove co-founded, Karl Rove being the former top political advisor to President George W. Bush. And these groups have, as I said, raised hundreds of millions of dollars together. Rove's group, American Crossroads, and an allied nonprofit, which does not have to disclose its donors, super PACs do, but nonprofits don't, hope to raise and spend $300 million. So the Democrats have been way outspent on this. They've belatedly last year, set up some of their own super PACs. They're still being outgunned, and the administration was in a bind because the president early on criticized the Citizens United ruling, and many Democrats said it was a poor decision. They thought that it would lead to unfair elections, and they criticized the court's ruling on multiple grounds. But that being the law, they've now faced a situation where they've had to adjust their views, or they have adjusted their views, to the reality of needing outside groups to support them. So the president has countenanced these groups now, has said that they're all right, and we've had a growth in the last year or so of some of these outside organizations formed by former top aides in the White House to President Obama. So whether they raise this tonight, is an open question. I think the president may give a brief reference to the fact that going forward, we need to do something on this issue.
So do you think that this, I get your point that he was critical about the very nature of this Citizens United decision. And I recall, of course, in the State of the Union when he was criticized it just shortly after it happened and Judge Alito mouthed something like not true, which I think in retrospect, as we get more distance and see the consequences of that ruling, it's pretty hard to believe that those Supreme Court justices, if they didn't intend it to have this outcome, I don't know why they're not redressing it. They had an opportunity and they turned it down. So the only thing you can assume is that either the majority on this court, the conservative majority in this court, really believe that the right wing in this country should have an unlimited advantage in a very cynical way, or they're somehow deluded. I mean, what's your reading on why they, Kennedy in particular, didn't take up this opportunity to change this law?
It's really hard to say. I mean, Kennedy, in retrospect, looks very naive for his decision, particularly his argument that there would be transparency about these donations. We've learned that there, for various reasons, there is not transparency, and there are legislative efforts underway, led by the Democrats in Congress, with some very minor Republican support. There are efforts underway to pass legislation that would lead to more transparency, disclosure of donations. But this certainly isn't going to happen this year. There's no way it's going to happen before the election. I imagine that that effort will be joined again next year, partly depending on, obviously, who wins the election and who's controlling Congress. But I think this battle is going to be a multi-year fight to adjust that decision or to change that decision.
So, again, I'm speaking with Peter Stone, who was formerly the head of the Money and Politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. He's been writing about money and politics for over two decades as a journalist for the Legal Times and the National Journal. His latest book is Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. He's now writing a new book on Citizens United and super PACs. It's interesting that Jack Abramoff really has had a Road to Damascus conversion, and is doing his best to expose these ugly practices in Washington, D.C., where money clearly rules. And it's clearly not having an effect, is it?
Well, his conversion is, it's hard to read just, you know, how thorough his conversion is. I mean, it's there are a lot of people out there who are skeptical about it. And I think it may be a making a virtue out of necessity, basically. I mean, he's out of prison. He went to jail for several years, convicted of fraud and conspiracy to corrupt public officials in 2006. Anyway, he got out about a year ago, and he's been talking on radio now. He's got a show, I believe, where he's does talk about reform issues, and he seems to be championing many reforms. He certainly speaks from experience as somebody who was in the middle of a lot of influence peddling that went way beyond, you know, what's legal. And so, you know, just how sincere it is, I'm not totally convinced. But he is talking a tough game now about reform, and I think to some extent he probably believes it.
Well, he's been very useful in exposing what an absolutely despicable, hypocritical little creep Ralph Reed is. But guess what? Ralph Reed's made a comeback. I mean, is it just that there's so much money and it's all so shameless that it doesn't matter, that nothing incremental can be done about cleaning up Washington? Something radical has to be done?
Well, there have been changes. I mean, there were changes in Congress. Congress passed laws that were enacted after the Abramoff scandal that limited certain types of influence peddling, limited the kinds of money that could be spent to buy members of Congress meals, outlawed certain practices, outlawed certain kind of trips taken by lobbyists and members. Lobbyists paying for members' trips and meals was outlawed. But there are a lot of loopholes, and there are other ways to exert influence in Washington. And we have a big new loophole, as I said, that was created by Citizens United, where now individuals can make contributions that go well, way, way, way beyond the legal limits of what can be given to an individual campaign. We're talking about campaign contribution limits of $2,500. And we are seeing seven-figure checks being written since 2010 by dozens of individuals. So the spigot has been opened much wider for certain kinds of influence. And I think we're going to probably see another cycle of reform coming up not too long from now, maybe after this year's election.
Well, Peter Stone, let's return to the conventions and President Obama's speech tonight. Covering the Tampa Republican convention earlier, I spoke with a campaign finance reform specialist on how much money was floating around. In other words, what we don't see on the cameras is all of these many, many parties that go on and seminars, et cetera, all of which are paid by corporate interests. And, you know, for example, the nation's biggest fracker in terms of fracking for gas, Chesapeake Energy down in Tampa, gave out natural gas-powered cars to everybody that they could find. And this kind of stuff goes on. I take it it's going on in Charlotte, right?
Well, sure, it's going on in Charlotte. And that's going on for, you know, conventions for many, many years. We've got, you know, again, dozens of corporations from major industries, whether it be energy or pharmaceuticals or financial services, who host events, who sponsor events. What's different this year, and I talked about this, and I wrote about this in Tampa, and it's happening in Charlotte too, is that we have these outside groups, the ones I've been talking about, who are now raising and spending tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on ads in battleground states to help Romney, and to a lesser in, you know, the Democrats are trying to catch up on this and help Obama. They're hosting events. They're hosting briefings for would-be donors. They're trying to raise money, as they did in Tampa. The same thing is going on in Charlotte. Briefings are underway for potential donors, and the idea is to get the Democratic groups, which I said are way behind the Republicans, into the game a bit more. They're not going to catch up. There's no way they're going to catch up this cycle, but they're trying to raise tens of millions more post-Charlotte, so they can do more ads and mount at least a challenge in some of the key states to what the Republican groups are spending. So we've had donor briefings by Karl Rove and others in Tampa. We have donor briefings going on in Charlotte, that some of which are being led by include members of Congress. The rules have a lot of leeway at these briefings. Candidates themselves can attend these briefings. They just can't ask. They just can't personally ask for unlimited amounts of money. We had Mitt Romney before the convention a year and a half ago when some of these groups were set up, when a super PAC to support Romney called Restore Our Future was set up. We had Romney going to some of their fundraisers and talking at some of their fundraisers. He left quickly. He didn't ask for money himself, but surrogates asked for money. In Charlotte, we've seen something interesting, too. We've seen Rahm Emanuel announce that he was leaving as honorary chairman of the campaign. This just was yesterday. Announced that he was leaving as honorary chairman of the campaign to help the key outside groups, the ones that can raise unlimited money, raise funds in the home stretch here. So this is what's different at this year's conventions. Corporations have long hosted events. That's not exactly new, and that's part of the business of conventions.
Well, Peter Stone, I thank you so much for joining us. I realize that we're not going to hear much about campaign finance reform from the president. I think it's a mistake on his part because, for example, the Occupy movement in many ways is motivated by a plague on both their houses because money rules, and it doesn't matter which party you vote for as long as they're both owned by the same interests. So if he were to distance himself, I think it would make some impact with a lot of people who are sitting on the fence.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens later on.
Well, thank you for joining us, Peter Stone.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Again, I've been speaking with Peter Stone, who was formerly the head of the Money and Politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. He's been writing about money and politics for over two decades as a journalist for the Legal Times and the National Journal. He began his career at the California-based muckraking magazine Ramparts, and his latest book is Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. He's now writing a new book on Citizens United and super PACs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.